Hi, welcome to the Leadership Standard. I'm Jamie Mason Cohen, the host, and I am thrilled to introduce you to our guest today, someone who you probably already know, at least on TV, Erica M. Erica's multifaceted career includes hosting the internationally syndicated TV series, Yummy Mummy, and serving as one of the pioneering Much Music VJs, where she spent a decade shaping the landscape of live music television. And her interviews with legends such as Kurt Cobain and Joan Jett continue to garner millions of views today. But that's just scratching the surface of her inspiring career and impact. And I know that because I have had the fortune and the privilege of getting to know Erica the past few years because we know each other through professional speaking circles. And we've collaborated and will continue to collaborate in the future. Erica, welcome to the Leadership Standard.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Thank you for the time. I would love to dive right in and go back to Erica in high school or when you were a teenager. Can you take us back to your first job in the music business? When and how did you get it?
Well, I can actually start even earlier. Before I was in the music business, I had Erica's teen scene column in the Hudson Gazette. I grew up in a really small town called Hudson, which is like 40 minutes west of Montreal. And I've always been maybe a cultural curator, shit disturber, leader. I don't know, but you choose the words, but I've always sort of put myself out there to speak on behalf of the people who I represent. So I started to do that when I was a student, when I was, I think, 14 or 15. I went to the local newspaper and said, I think I should do a column for you. And they couldn't come up with a reason as to why I shouldn't. And I mean, I got paid. It was great. And then I moved to Montreal to go to CEGEP. And I saw the program director of Shome FM at a concert for the Cars. I had met him previously when I ran a contest for my school, which was Marianopolis College. And so I walked up to him at the Cars concert and I said, "Hi, I'm Erica. I'm that girl from Marianopolis. Can I have a job at Shome?" And he kind of looked at me and said, "I'm not working right now. I'm just enjoying a show. You can call my assistant," thinking that he would get rid of me. But nope, I was tenacious. I called up his assistant and I did get a meeting and showed up. Asked him once again for a job, and he said no. And I was surprised. I said, "But you told me to come back." He said, "Listen, you're still in school. I cannot hire you." He didn't add, "And you're 16, but that was the point. He said, "But if you want, you could be my personal music librarian. So you're essentially allowed to come to the building at any time. You can organize the albums." There were not CDs yet at the time. "And you get to hang out with, you know, any of the artists who come in. You get to know the DJs. Would you like that?" I was like, "Yeah." So that was my very first job, is working at Shome FM, the coolest rock radio station in Montreal.
Okay, so those are your humble beginnings of everyone has to start somewhere. How did you transition from that job as the music librarian as a teenager to City TV and Much Music?
What I do is I plant a lot of seeds. I still do it. It's just the way that, I guess you'd call it the way I hustle, where I never expect that anybody is going to offer me anything. And I've been pretty accurate in that. Almost everything that has happened in my life is because I've made the cold call. I've knocked on the door. I've emailed someone. I've asked. So I started to do a ton of jobs in the music business at a very young age. I was working at A&A Records and Sam the Record Man at the same time. I managed artists. I DJed in punk clubs and new wave clubs. I got my degree at Ottawa University in communications while working, obviously, at Records on Wheels in Ottawa. And then I had an opportunity to reach out to Moses Znaimer, who runs City TV, because I wanted to be a part of the spectacular and innovative TV show that was The New Music. That was the preeminent television show about alternative music around the world. It was the coolest show. And so I did get a job answering the phones for The New Music. And that was the beginning of me kind of infiltrating City TV. Now, at the time, there was no much music. I just wanted to be part of The New Music show. And after 3 years, we did get the license for Much Music. I had also worked at the local cable company while I worked full-time at City and Much on camera. How did I get that job? Well, I cold called the guy who runs the local programming at the local cable company and said, "Hi, my name's Erica. I work at City TV answering the phones and I'd like my own show on McLean Hunter Cable." And he went, "Okay, sure, come on down." So those are the kinds of things that I've done.
What I'm hearing so far and what I'm really responding to, because it's so relatable for people, is, first of all, I love the line, or in your words, you got to ask. So you've always been someone who asked, and you combine asking with a fierce, persistent determination to take one step, even when there's a no, closer. So a series of no's eventually is going to get you closer to your goal.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, when I started to, when I launched YMC, or it was called Yummy Mummy Club, which was an online magazine for platform, really for women with children, I was way ahead of my time. It was before there were sort of online communities. This was in 2006. But I saw a need for someone to start speaking out about the realities of modern motherhood, because moms today are very different than our parents' generation. And so I started this little website and it started to really take off. Lots of followers, lots of community. And then PR companies would call me up and they'd say, "Hey, you know, we've got this great room. Can you share it with your audience?" And I was like, "Sure, what's your budget?" And they were, "What? What do you mean?" And I was like, "Pay to play, buddy. This is my job." And then I realized that I had to be very aggressive, proactive in monetizing my business. So I came up with a whole series of different tactics that brands can use my team to tell their brand story. So that's where the cold calling started. I had to cold call for probably 3 months. And I took full advantage of my name, because I had a household name in Canada, Erica M. Calling. All these brand managers would take my call because they'd say, "What, Erica M., like from Much Music?" I said, "Sure." But I would say, "I started my own business. This is what it is. And these are the opportunities for you to connect with moms in meaningful ways." And they listened and they went, "Well, that's really fantastic. But no, because you know that Canadians are not quick to jump on any kind of new ideas, right?" Well, it took me months for one person to say yes. And her name is Samantha Kemp Jackson. And I will never forget her name. She was working at Apex PR. And she said, "Oh, that's interesting. I think my client Fuji could use this. We'll take the whole thing." So she bought the entire program. I was able to build the program. I was able to deliver it. And then I was able to give her a really kick-ass wrap report that showed her the great engagement and the reach that the program got. And then I was able to use that to go back to all the people who said no to me and said, "Here's an example of how it works." And very slowly, I started to get a few more yeses and still a lot of no's, but you know, the weight started to change. And I think that is, if for anybody who wants to succeed in life, you cannot be dissuaded by those who say no, because as my ex-husband says so wisely, there's a seat for every toilet. Not everyone is going to get what you're doing. That doesn't mean that what you're doing isn't good. But actually, you can also learn from people saying no. When someone turns you down, rather than, you know, starting to bawl or, you know, slam the phone down or something, you can ask them, "Great, can you tell me why? Is it not the right product for you? Do you not understand it? Is it the wrong timing?" And you get to learn, because we all can learn to listen and grow and adapt. Because, you know, even though I think I'm brilliant, I think that there is definitely room for me to learn from my peers.
Yes. And I've learned a lot from you. And one of those things I've learned is if we go back to the beginning of Yummy Mummy, which we've been talking about here in terms of your process to get to where it ended up becoming a successful and really groundbreaking or pioneering company in its time, moving and it continues to this day have influence and impact. One thing I've learned from you is that if you start a company, there needs to be a powerful why. There needs to be something that was greater than yourself. And it doesn't always have to be connected to you in terms of what your experience is. Yet if it is, it can be the foundation or it can help in terms of that resilience. When you feel like quitting or when you feel like saying, I've had enough, it's that purpose which can help you move forward during those tough times. Can you take us back to the beginning of Yummy Mummy as to why you, as a mum yourself, started this particular brand?
Sure. I was a new mom and felt very alone. And I also felt like the worst mom on the planet. And so I decided that I wanted to start learning about motherhood. And so I started to write articles and talk to others or to professionals in the industry and also confess to other moms at how lost I felt. And I was shocked that many of my fellow moms said the same thing. And I realized that we're all living with this, I guess, imposter syndrome that we are the worst moms, but nobody would say it out loud. And I do feel somewhat of a responsibility because when you become a well-known personality, you also appear to be bulletproof. You appear to be shiny and perfect because you're on TV. But I was anything but that. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to start telling my story and my truth. And my tagline at the beginning was, you're not alone. And other moms started to join in and say, I'm so glad you're saying that out loud. I've been saying that and I felt terrible that I didn't want to tell anybody. And that's terrible. And then you think about all the postpartum depression. If we don't say those kind of scary things out loud, we're hurting each other. And so I'm okay confessing my imperfections. And then we all can open up to each other. So that was really, I had a purpose to bring women together to share the ups and downs of modern motherhood, the realities of it, we celebrate and commiserate because a lot of motherhood sucks. So I said it out loud. People go, oh, how can you say that? We love our children. Yeah, not always. Not always. There are times when it's hard. There are times when relationships break up because of our children. There are times where we feel like we are not accomplishing anything in our lives because we're at our kids' beck and call. We used to be type A businesswomen. So all of that became integrated into what I call the tapestry of voices that I created, bringing women across the country and giving them a platform to tell their stories.
Yeah, and I've gone on Yummy Mummy over the years and read some of the blogs as a dad and as a dad of two young kids, of a son and a daughter. And I remember telling my wife, this is really helpful. We should read this because this is something that they don't teach you as a father or as a mother. Mm-hmm. And another thing about you that is reflected in Yummy Mummy is you're so, I would call, fiercely authentic. Like, you really have this a way about you that is honest and vulnerable and not afraid to admit mistakes, yet you're also fearless in moving forward. So it's this beautiful paradox within you that I've seen. And
if I can interrupt for a second, which I tend to do a lot, I feel like that is a recipe for success for anyone who is listening to this or watching this or taking this in some form, to be unabashedly yourself and fierce. Fierce means fiercely committed to who you are, but also fiercely open to listening. So I don't mean it's just a one-way conversation, but if you are not comfortable in your own skin and don't truly understand what your purpose is, what your core values are, then how do you make any decisions in life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pausing for a moment because I'm seeing people, some words come in from audience members, and someone wrote, I loved Yummy Mummy. My daughter was born in 2005. It made me feel not alone, from Nola Simon.
Oh, thank you, Nola. Nola's amazing. She's a great communicator.
Yes, she is. Let's, on that note, transition to something, which is knowing you on as a friend, something that people might not know about you is that you are an introvert, or more of an introvert than an extrovert. At least you can correct me if I'm wrong. I know you will. And so we're live now where we are being seen, we are being heard. And so often now for people, for business owners, for entrepreneurs, for chairs of business groups, to get our message out, we are creating content of some kind or another. And you're masterful at creating content along the lines of what we've talked about. Is I remember we did something together on Facebook Live, and my mom was, I told her to log on, and my mother said, I don't really know that much about Erica, but I just like her. She's like, she just is someone, I feel like I could connect with. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the way you show up that makes people feel a connection. And so my question to you, Erica, is what is it like to be a hardcore introvert and be on camera for a living? Was it hard for you? And what advice would you have for others who are more introverted if they're putting themselves out there and creating their own content and they're more introverted?
Okay, those are a lot of questions that I have to remember to answer. Being an introvert is, for me, being at a party when everybody is talking at the same time and trying to get attention, and I just want to hide in a corner. The other hand is, I feel very passionate about the things that I talk about. I have purpose and I have core values, and I desperately want to connect with people who are listening. I feel like I am a teacher, and you know what I'm talking about since you are also a teacher, where I feel like, not that I have the answers, but I can give people the confidence to find the answers. I think that's more what my skill is. Usually I'm in your chair, where I like to be the one asking the questions because of my, call it empathy. I'm always thinking, what does the person on the other side of the camera want to know? And so I have conversations like you're doing really right now with my guests to make them feel, number one, comfortable. To be themselves, because when someone is relaxed, they can open up about what their expertise and passion is. But if they feel like they're being judged or have to fit in a certain box, then they're going to sort of not be themselves and not give us the great value that everybody has inside of them. So I think for me, I'm an introvert because I'm quiet. I like to listen. I really enjoy listening. But on the other hand, I love being interviewed when there's someone like you who actually knows how to listen. And I feel like I'm not wasting my time because you're taking in what I'm saying.
Well, thank you. One interview you did, which has gone viral, was in 1993 with Kurt Cobain, the legendary frontman of Nirvana. And if you haven't had a chance to watch it, whether or not you were a fan of Nirvana, if you watch the way that Erica conducted that interview, it really is a masterclass in how to connect with a person who you just met, who might be a little bit standoffish or might not trust opening up that quickly. So do you feel that your ability as an introvert, as an empathetic introvert, as someone who is modeling this level of listening, that was helpful for you in helping connect with him as quickly as you did?
Yeah, I think when you conduct interviews, the interview is not about you, it's about the other person. So my only job is to make the other person feel seen and heard and respected. And so the questions that I asked him were questions that I genuinely wanted to know. And they were questions that treated him like a human being. And then when he talked, I listened and I would respond back to him. I would say, well, why do you say that? What does that mean? How? Well, that must have been hard. And then you can see his eyes light up like, oh, she's actually listening to what I'm saying. Then what happens is it stops being an interview and it starts being a conversation where two humans are connecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was palpable. So even though you were off camera, because the camera was focused on him for the majority of the time from that angle, you could feel very rapidly his energy shift immediately from the first few minutes in the first question when you were asking him things where you, like you said, like I observed, you wanted to get to know him as a person. And it wasn't just as this objectified star that you were trying to pull something from. It was
I think in general, people don't like to be treated like they're stars. And I mean like CEOs or people who have positions of power in companies. Nobody wants to be treated like that because it makes you feel uncomfortable. Like, how do you respond to that? So talking to people like they're human beings, no matter what position they have, you will build a connection with them. Like people who are important in your company, they have their own insecurities and their own needs. And they also probably are uncomfortable not knowing how to, like, do I just generally say a jovial hello to the people in the halls now? Like everybody is struggling to communicate. And if you are comfortable in your own skin, it's a great gift tool to make connections in the corporate world and your personal life. But treat people like they're human beings first. Don't treat them like what their job title is.
I love that. Can we do a quick speed round that's inspired by your interview with Kurt Cobain?
Maybe. Okay.
Yeah. I pulled a few questions that you asked him.
Oh, okay.
I thought would be perfect for our speed round.
Okay.
The first of three questions is, what's a book that keeps coming back to you in your life that's memorable to you?
Oh, I'm going to surprise you with this one. It's The Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games. Why?
Yeah. Well, because I'm trying to write a dystopian novel right now. And it's been 5 years that I've been sort of working it in my head. And that book is, my book is going to be nothing like that book, but there's a lot of things that it does in that book that I like. So I keep on going back to it saying, how did they do that? Or how did she do that? So her name is Susan Collins. So, you know, weirdly enough, that's one of them. And then on the other hand, there's a book called Creativity. I forget who the author is, but he was the founder of Pixar. And he talks about why creativity is so essential for large corporate, well, for every kind of corporation, but a lot of large corporations. And my favorite example was when he talked about how a lot of companies, when they reach the pinnacle or what they consider to be the pinnacle of their success, they are the top selling car brand or the best selling smartphone. What happens is when you reach that point, you start to become a little bit complacent or comfortable because you are the best. But what happens is there's all these little startups, these smaller companies who are lean and mean, and they're watching everything that you're doing. And we, by nature, humans are creative. We're always inventing new ideas. And so they're looking at what you're doing and they're coming up with their own newer, leaner, more modern, less expensive way of doing what you're doing. And as if you take your eyes off the prize and stop innovating and don't feel like there's someone at your butt, you will tumble. And that's exactly what happened with the record business. In the media world, they got complacent and arrogant and stopped innovating, pushed away all those young companies coming to them saying, I've got this new product to help you innovate. They're like, get away from me, kid. I own this space. And look what happened. All these small little companies started eating away at their market share. And then they all started to crumble.
Okay. Excellent. Our next question is, and it's a question you asked in a different context, in a different time, in a different age, Kurt Cobain, is can money buy happiness?
That's a really good question for me to have to answer, because I struggle with that an awful lot. And I would have to say, I'm actually working as a consultant with a wealth management company. And it has become clear to me that wealth is actually more than money, because it's sort of like Wall Street, which is like, how many motor boats do you need to ski behind? So I think it's people use money to fill holes. There's a certain amount that we need so that we can live a comfortable life. But I think we focus too much on money and not enough about the joys in life and appreciating what we have, gratitude.
Do you have some type of gratitude practice that focuses on those other components other than finances?
Yes, it was you that made me do it. Remember when we went live? You went live. I learned it from you. How funny is that? I asked Jamie to come on the YMC Facebook page. We did a live conversation like this, and you were talking about the power of the written word and gratitude journals. And so I do it. I actually do it. I keep a book beside my bedside table. And at night, I just think about three or four things that I'm really grateful for.
Wow. That made my day. Thanks for sharing. And our final speed round question is, Erica, what excites you right now?
Well, I am in a... I put myself in the mindset of being hired to do things that make me supremely uncomfortable. And it's very exciting. These new opportunities are popping up that leverage my skills in ways that I didn't understand I even had. But when I have connected with people, they're saying, oh, we would like you to do this for our company. I was like, do I do that? They went, of course you can do it. I'm like, okay, I'm doing it. So I think that to me is the concept. I chose a word for myself this year, which is daring. Daring to put myself in really uncomfortable positions, because I've come to understand that I can do anything. I just need to be put in the position that forces me to learn and adapt and rise to the occasion.
What's an example of that where, on a positive front in the past, where you put yourself in an uncomfortable position as an entrepreneur, though it doesn't necessarily have to be an entrepreneur, that embodies when you've been at your best?
Well, it was a very difficult situation. I'll be candid with you. My mother was going through cancer. My daughter was having mental health issues. My company was earning $1.5 million, and it was too big for me. I couldn't do it all. So I hired someone to run the company so I could step back. And he almost bankrupted my company after 3 years. And he said to me, oh, you don't have to fire me. I'm just going to, I'll just walk away. I was like, well, that's very generous of you. But I had to fire everybody in the company because I couldn't pay them. And I had to deliver so many programs because people pay in advance. Everything got delivered, even though I had nobody working for me. I had to rebuild the team and I was able to do it. I thought I was dead, but I built it once. I was able to build it again. And then I sold it to Toys R Us Canada. And I realized at that moment that I was a freaking superhero because I never expected, first of all, to be in that terrible position. And I had no idea if I could rebuild it. And I was able to, because we do, we can. If you want to, you just work really hard, find people to support you. I went to people, my people who used to work for me or people that I had working relationships. I don't burn my bridges ever. So people came and helped me. And it's a really special time in my life. It was probably the worst time in my life and not necessarily the best time, but certainly a highlight in my life.
You just, I feel, encompassed everything you've been talking about. And the gift you just gave me as a listener is, in those darkest moments, there are seeds of opportunities that are there for a reason on some higher dimension or level that can propel us forward in our next endeavor. So thank you for modeling vulnerability and authenticity on the level that you're speaking that resonates with you and others.
I feel like my superpower is really being an opportunist. And when I say that word, sometimes people get that ick look on their face, like, Erica, why would you step on other people to get ahead? But I think that the term opportunist has shifted over the years, where at least in my lexicon, it means finding mutually beneficial situations where both parties win through collaborating. And that has been probably, aside from being unafraid to ask and be authentic, that's one of my superpowers, is being an opportunist and finding opportunities where we both benefit and we both rise, or all rise together. That's the key. That's what leadership is. It's when we all rise together. Leadership is not someone at the top of a chain barking instructions. That's a boss. A leader who is someone at the bottom of the chain, who is providing mentorship, motivation, suggestions, who is there to support the team and help everybody rise up. That's leadership.
And moving forward, what is your criteria for partnering with collaborators, leaders, or other opportunists? What do you look for in them?
I guess who they are is people, because the people that you work with are people. They become, they become colleagues. And so I don't like to align myself with people who I don't respect in terms of their values, the way they treat people, what their concept of leadership is, all of that. It's pretty evident. You could see how people treat other people. So I think certainly who they are as individuals, also what's the purpose behind what it is that they're doing. So if they're doing something just to make money, ick, not that interesting for me. But if there is some sort of a purpose where many people benefit in some way, that excites me.
What do you think you want to be known for when you're gone one day?
I think just that I made the world a better place, that I spread positivity and helped people, changed people's lives in small ways. And then it sort of creates a ripple of positivity.
And you do that, from what I've observed from a distance and getting to know you. What have you learned about being a mother
Well, I think now that my kids are older, I realized something really profound that not many people told me. I think I did it inherently, but you have to begin the way you want it to end. So if you want to have a great relationship with your kids as a teenager, you need to treat them with respect from a very young age. You have to build communication with them. You have to set boundaries from a very young age. You have to be consistent. You have to listen. These are all basically the same things that you would do with your employees. These are the same things. It's build a relationship of trust and reciprocity of communication. And then as your kids get older, that mutual respect comes is very important when your kids go off the rails when they're 13, 14, 15. And I have some friends who didn't have a very close relationship with their kids. They kind of lost them. Now, my kids went off the rails, but I didn't lose them. My kids are no different than any other kids. Like, it's not like I suddenly raised angels. I didn't. But I never lost our relationship. And that's the most important thing, I think, as a parent, that you are the safe place for your kids to be.
Yeah, as a father, that's always front and center in my mind is, am I prioritizing the relationship and how there's no such, I can't be fully balanced in my relationship with an entrepreneur and being a dad, yet my purpose is completely connected directly to my kids' well-being and my wife. And so that word to me is crucial, is what am I doing as a parent to build that relationship, to nurture it, to cultivate it?
Well, isn't that what every relationship should be? Again, I keep on bringing it back to the world of work. Isn't that what a leader should be doing? Isn't that's a parent is a leader. Parent is guiding a child through their life and inspiring them, motivating them, but also making it okay for the kids to fail, not yelling at the kids if they make a mistake or if they don't get good marks or if they don't choose a path that the parent wants for them. Right? You allow them to grow as human beings. But the key word is grow. And when you have people work for you, if you let them make mistakes and listen to them and let them grow, they will be connected and suddenly you won't be losing employees all the time because they'll feel that respected and seen, just like parents.
I'm going to make a transition here to some research I did on you and hearing another podcast. So I'm going to jump right in and give that context, and it connects with what we're talking about. And earlier, and again, correct me if I'm wrong with these details, but early on, a couple of years in, about 4 years into Much Music, you felt that the culture was not necessarily negative, yet it wasn't exactly supportive or nurturing of you in terms of they said that you're replaceable. So the communication was, there's a lot of people who could fill these shoes. So, just be happy you have this. And we don't want to hear any, we don't really want to hear or recognize anything other than this job is a good job and take it. We've also just talked about, you mentioned leadership. A component of that is helping people rise up, is bringing out the best in others. And we were talking about parenting in terms of relationships and building those relationships, and how you speak to children really matters in building those bonds. What advice would you have for leaders when it comes to positive, constructive, inspiring communication to help them rise or raise their teams?
There's a book that I think everyone should read. Rose Patton, she's a chancellor at Rotman Business School, and she wrote a book about inspiring leadership. I think I can't remember the exact name of the book. But what she wrote was for me, mind-blowing, probably because she was able to articulate what I feel. She's done all the research. She's an academic. I'm just someone who is in it and tries to name it. She believes that there has been a huge shift in the qualities required for leadership today. The world has changed. So she said the concept of once a leader, always a leader, not true. Once a leader does not necessarily fit into the culture of business today. So the top-down approach, the paternalistic, if you will, the patriarchal approach with, you know, someone in charge who says kindly, this is the way we do it here, and you will listen to what we say. You will not argue. You will follow the rules. That doesn't work anymore, partly because people are now empowered to talk back. There's more opportunity out there for them to find jobs using the internet and stuff. You know, it's just a different world. And there's also the opportunity to clap back at leaders, you know, to verbally, publicly shame them for, you know, and to build movements where if someone does something, what the employee considers to be negative, it could spread like wildfire and really be detrimental to the company, not just to the leader. She said that the qualities that leaders in the past had, which was, you know, firm grip and a knowledge of numbers and, you know, almost like a military kind of strength. She said, it's totally changed, where leadership today requires empathy, flexibility, resilience, positivity, motivation. They're, in a way, a series of soft skills. And to me, that it shocked me that I felt that. For example, in the past, at Much Music, when I was, it was a little more subtly suggested to me that, you know, just remember, you're replaceable. And I remember thinking, why would they say that to me? Why would they not say to me, we think you're the cat's ass, and we are so grateful for all the work that you put in to make Much Music memorable. We value you so much. I would have done anything for them. But because they kind of hinted that they didn't really appreciate everything that I gave, I started to look elsewhere. I started all kinds of companies while I worked at Much Music. I had a record label, songwriter, I wrote a book, I was doing plays, I did voiceovers. I was planting seeds for that inevitable day when they kind of hinted that they could fire me. So if I was the boss of Much Music, I wouldn't give people cause to start looking elsewhere. I would tell them that they are appreciated and that if they're having problems in their job, to come to me and let's see if I could fix those problems for you because you are valued here. And I did that. I directly used that experience when I started YMC, and my staff, I have people who work, I have one woman who still works for me after 15 years. And she quit once, but she tried to quit three times. And each time she quit, I would say, wait, before you quit, just tell me what is the problem that you're having. And let's see if we can solve that problem. So sometimes it was a person. So I had to do a little bit of people management, but sometimes she was just bored. And she wanted a different job. I went, oh, well, don't quit. I'll get somebody to do that job. And let's give you a different job that's way harder. So I don't know if managers, leaders do that enough, where they really connect with their staff and give them opportunities to grow and be heard.
And it sounds to me like this is walking, talking, strength-based leadership in action, where you're focusing on what their strengths are, recognizing the whole person, the holistic person. You're not ignoring blind spots. So you're definitely diving into what you admire, what their skills, what value they have, and letting them know that subtly and in different ways.
Yes. And if someone is not performing properly, have a conversation with them. Not a threatening conversation. It's tell us what the problem is. Why can we support you? We want you to grow, because we both know that when someone works for a company and they leave, they take all the, their your IP with them. They can't unlearn what they already know about your company. And they also take all that time that you spent training them. You also know that you're going to have to now find somebody to replace them. That's expensive, both in terms of manpower and training the person to get up to speed. Why not just focus on retention and building a better system where people feel appreciated, valued, that there's an opportunity to grow and learn from what your employees are telling you? That's the kind of leadership that Rose Patton is talking about, which is more of a better communication and respect, you know, like mutual respect. It sounds so old-fashioned, but it's, to me, it's the future.
It's the future. In the past, other than Kurt Cobain, who was someone you interviewed? It could be famous, someone we know, maybe someone we might not be as familiar with, who represented a form of authentic, who communicated authentically in how they showed up. And one example that they didn't necessarily demonstrate who they were in front of the camera and behind the camera.
Oh, so easy. This was Red Hot Chili Peppers. So that was a really famous interview, now infamous, let's say, where they were just sexist, misogynist jerks to me on Much Music. And it was maybe good TV, if you want to call it that, watching Erica squirm, being in a very difficult position where these guys were quite rude. And not just to me, but when Much Music back in the day was watched very closely by the CRTC. So they had very strict rules and language. You can't swear. You know, like, it was very important that there were certain protocols in how we communicated on camera. So they were ignoring it. Anyway, they were really rude, obnoxious. And then as soon as we'd go to commercial break, they were like, is that okay? Is that too much? I was like, oh, you guys are fucking liars. You're fakers. You're not bad boys. You're acting like bad boys. That's why I don't like them.
Yeah. Yeah. That, and I recall hearing about that and being surprised, because a band or public figures who you admire in one way, and then hearing how they act when you don't see them behind the scenes, even though that was partially in front of the scenes, was surprising. What about a positive example, other than Kurt Cobain, who really left you with a positive feeling about someone who you might have admired, as going back to being a music librarian, being a real connoisseur of new music, and then you met them and they were at the level that you hoped they would be, or they in some way surpassed it in terms of how they showed up authentically as a communicator?
Well, maybe it would be the guys from Duran Duran. So that was early on in my an early interview, and it was very chaotic because they were the biggest band on the planet at the time, and there was a bit of a riot before when they arrived, and all the girls were screaming and as their limo arrived. And it was early days of Much, so we were even more free to do whatever we wanted. And they were just acting really kooky and like shooting me with water guns and stuff. But Simon Le Bon, who is the lead singer of the band, he kept on looking at me he looked me right in the eye and would kind of nod imperceptibly to make sure that I was okay. Wow. So he wasn't trying to make me feel uncomfortable. He just knew how to do good TV. And so do I. And I was like, yeah, I would look at him and smile every once in a while. And off we went. It was so much fun because great TV is when there's chaos, but well-intentioned. Neither of us wanted to make the other person look bad. It was so much fun. That's the difference between the Red Hot Chili Peppers and these guys. These guys included me in the fun. Red Hot Chili Peppers did it at my expense.
Okay. What a distinction that is.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. The level of empathy in Simon Le Bon, you said, that's next level in terms of the lights, the cameras, their image, and yet he's finding a way to shift to you to make sure that are we laughing together, not being mm-hmm. laughed at? Are we comfortable? And that was before a time when people maybe even had these conversations.
I don't think that he even knew what he was doing, to be honest. And I even maybe making it up. But I've watched that interview a few times and I see him looking, you know, his eyes just sort of shifting over to me. And I think he was just polite. He was just like a nice person. And I wasn't a big fan of the band. It wasn't like, I was intimidated or in awe of them. It was fun, obviously. I was interviewing Duran Duran. But my job and his job is to be entertainers. And we did a great job of that together. Just like we're doing now, Jamie.
Just like we're doing now. And on that note, I'd like to ask you a final question.
Sure.
Erica, 12 months from now, and I'm sure we'll see each other. We're supposed to see each other in a couple of weeks, so we're going to see each other before that. But 12 months from now, if we were to get together, what are you celebrating?
My book will be done.
Okay. And what's your book about?
Well, I can't tell everybody. Okay. All I can tell you, it's dystopian, and it speaks to disinformation and anxiety, depression, technology, and my daughter.
And there's nobody better to write it because you are a true Renaissance person and you displayed, as you always do in every interaction I've seen of you, as a friend, when you're on stage, in your writings, authenticity, fierce vulnerability, really insight into so many different areas, both professionally and personally. Mm. And I just want to thank you for your time. But before we go, where can we reach you to learn more about your various projects?
Well, you know, the world of social media, it's so, there are so many sort of front doors, if you will. LinkedIn is always good. Well, here we are. So yes, I'm sort of active on LinkedIn. I have a website, ericam.com, which hasn't been updated because, you know, it's the irony is when you're busy, you don't update your own website. And then I guess Instagram, and I call it Twitter. You could find me, just Google me, you'll find me.
Okay, on that note, Erica, thank you so much. For our audience, thank you for listening and watching. This is The Leadership Standard. I'm Jamie Mason Cohen, and don't forget to subscribe to hear more interviews with world-class leaders. Thanks, and have a good day.